This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.
This state is on a roll. 365,000 jobs in 2 years and 8 months. Unemployment below the national average. I think the whole country is going to keep watching our success.
Governor Rick Scott this week at a South Dade County AT&T retail store, talking up his record on job creation in the governor's office. While more Floridians are finding work, more of those that are out of work and relying on weekly unemployment checks may have been having some trouble with the state's new unemployment website. The Department of Economic Opportunity is responsible for the unemployment system in Florida and the agency in charge of the $63 million overhaul of that website. The department's executive director concedes several thousand people are having significant issues with the new system.
We also have, again, on the technical side, teams of programmers that work in shifts around the clock to address issues. Our number one priority is helping claimants who are having issues, and I want to assure every claimant that as long as they are legally entitled to the benefits, they will still get them. We will get to every claim.
Jesse Panuccio, the executive director of the Florida Department of Economic Opportunity, have you been having trouble signing up for unemployment benefits in the past 3 weeks? Have you gotten those checks? Have you missed an unemployment check? Join our conversation here on the Florida Roundup on WLRN at 800-743-WLRN. Toll-free call from throughout Florida, 800-743-9576. Email us at thefloridaroundup@wlrnnews.org or tweet at WLRN. That's the call sign or the live chat now ongoing online at WLRN.org. On the Florida Roundup to discuss this technical snafu, Steve Bosquet from the Tampa Bay Times with us from the Bay Area and Gina Jordan from WLRN Miami Herald in Tallahassee. Gina, first of all, from the capital city, has the site been fixed?
Well, not yet. Certainly not as of late yesterday, but state officials are hoping they will get all the glitches worked out this weekend. They're hoping by Sunday it'll be fixed.
It's been 3 weeks now, Steve. What do we know about these problems?
Well, that they've been festering for a while, and they've resulted in long lines. Not only people queued up to use the telephone system, but people now who go to these so-called one-stop centers around the state are also facing long lines. My colleague Mike Van Sickler in the Tampa Bay Times in Tallahassee has found hundreds and hundreds of emails that people have sent to Governor Rick Scott's email inbox complaining about this situation, and some people are really, really desperate here to get help.
Yeah, unemployment claims is not a lot of money, but for those folks without work and without an income, that $200 or $250, $275 maximum per week can certainly add up quickly. And if you're missing those checks for 3 weeks in a row, Steve, as you know, that can be a significant impediment to just keeping food on the table.
It is. And let's look at the calendar. We're coming up to the point in the calendar year when people are most concerned about having enough money. We're coming up into Thanksgiving and Christmas and Hanukkah, you know, important holidays. People are with loved ones, or they want to travel, or they want to, you know, drive someplace across the state. This really has to get fixed. This is becoming a major, major problem for the Rick Scott administration.
If anybody has had trouble with the unemployment site in Florida, a family member, a colleague, perhaps a former colleague, let us know at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Gina Jordan from WLRN Miami Herald News in Tallahassee. Gina, what do we know about the company behind this? This was outsourced to Deloitte, a technology consultancy company that operates worldwide. Why so much trouble with this overhaul?
Well, that's a good question. This is a New York-based firm, and apparently they've had problems like this in other states as well. They had similar problems with the new unemployment system in Massachusetts. They've also had issues in California and Pennsylvania. They even had some trouble in Miami-Dade. You know, back in 2009, they were in the middle of a contract with the school district, and essentially they were fired because they just they couldn't turn anything. So, you know, that's a good question. This does not reflect very well on this company.
No, in fact, when 16 months ago, back in the summer of 2012, the state of Florida was perhaps a little bit concerned about this overhaul project and the direction it was going. It threatened to cancel this contract with Deloitte. But instead, Deloitte appointed, I believe, a new project manager, increased the staff working on it there in Tallahassee, Gina. But yet it still cost more than originally negotiated. And, Steve, it took almost a year longer than anticipated.
It did. Let's keep something in mind here. The agency that's in charge of getting these bugs fixed and dealing with this system is the Department of Economic Opportunity. It's the same agency that is used mainly to recruit and retain jobs in the state. The number one mission for this agency is to do these job incentive deals that Rick Scott talks about so much. So they're, you know, they're having to sort of like use both hands at the same time on two very important issues here.
Yeah, and we'll be talking about that public-private partnership called Enterprise Florida, which talked up its success this week, but also weathered a lot of criticism in a moment. But back to this Department of Economic Opportunity and its mission here, at least with this particular website, to provide unemployment claims and a filing system online. Have we been given any indication, Steve, on the part of the Scott administration, of when these technical snafus will be cleared up, and folks who will be in line for their unemployment benefits and lawfully deserve them will be able to get them?
No, I'm not aware of any specific deadline, but here's the issue. Next week, the Florida legislature is back at the state capitol for a week of committee meetings, and there are going to be committee meetings in the Senate and the House on this very issue, this Connect system, and the flaws that it's got.
And Gina Jordan in Tallahassee, U.S. Senator Bill Nelson actually wants a federal investigation into this. What's the federal jurisdiction with the state issue?
Well, the Labor Department enforces the federal laws that cover the workplace activities and that impact workers, including those who are unemployed. Yeah. So he's asking the labor secretary to make sure that the state is doing everything it can to correct these problems. But he also wants the feds to find out what happened with the rollout. You know, why? Because so many people have been impacted. You got people saying that they're not going to get their money now because they can't even find a human being to speak to.
There have been some stories, Steve, of thousands of people calling the agency and only 25 able to get through to speak with an operator.
That's right. My colleague, Brittany Elena Davis, who works for the Tampa Bay Times, has been documenting these cases of very sadly people crying, very distraught. Yeah. Unable to get through, unable to get assistance.
All right. We've got Tom joining the Florida Roundup today from Pompano Beach. Tom, welcome to the program. Tell us your story.
Well, it's the story of my sister and my son. My sister told me she spent 30 hours just trying to get a hold of somebody. And, she's, for one thing, she's a union member. My son's a union member, too. And union members take their jobs from the hiring hall. And they're tagging a lot of union members, trying to prevent them from getting unemployment insurance, trying to tell them they have to go, search for a job someplace else when these union members have their benefits and their pensions with their union. And that's where they've always taken their jobs from.
Well, your sister's a union member. You're saying that the trouble she's had is with the Department of Economic Opportunity telephone unemployment benefit claim system. Is that right?
Right. And that, well, they even when they put in the system that they take their jobs from the union, it's like they've tagged it where that they can't go any further. They have to go to the one-stop center. And then she went to the one-stop center, and they gave her a great big hassle over that.
Well, it sounds like she was at least successful in being able to file it online, though.
No, and they have a right to take their jobs from the union. They still prevented her from getting her unemployment. And she had to spend hours and hours more on the phone. And then she finally talked to somebody in Tallahassee, got somebody in Tallahassee on the phone, and the person in Tallahassee said, well, I don't know what they did that for. You got the right to take your jobs from the union.
All right. Tom joining us from Pompano Beach discussing perhaps a bit more of a procedural problem. We've been talking about the technical problem, the rollout for the new unemployment online claim system here in the state of Florida. We've got Gina Jordan from WLRN Miami Herald News in Tallahassee, Steve Bosque from Tampa Bay Times with us from Tampa Bay, and Patrick now joins the Florida Roundup. Patrick from Palmetto Bay. Let me see if I can get him back on the horn here. Patrick, go ahead. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir.
Tell us your story.
Briefly, I'm driving, so I will not stay on the phone too long. The new system that they have in aid, I'm listening to your program every day. So anyway, I'm trying to say that the system that they have in aid is a total fiasco. When I was in the military, they say if something is functioning properly, do not play with it. And the old system was functioning properly, and they had to muddle with it and put a lot of webs in it. And it is hard for anyone to get help or to file for unemployment. And even at the one-stop center, I took pictures of people who were supposed to helping us. They are there chit-chatting, for about nothing. And whenever you ask them for help, they don't bother ask, you know, for help, because they themselves don't know what the, you know, the fuck is what they're talking about.
Patrick from Palmetto Bay expressing the frustrations, Steve and Gina, that we hear from out-of-work Floridians trying to file. Gina or Steve, why was this system in need of overhaul?
They had a very, very old system. It was almost out of the Stone Age, what they were using up there. It goes back 20 or 30 years. There's no question in my mind that they needed an upgraded, modern system to deal with the number of calls and the amount of feedback they need to have with the general public here trying to get benefits and get claims processed.
That is Steve Bosquet from Tampa Bay Times with us from Tampa Bay. Gina Jordan from WLRN Miami Herald News in Tallahassee talking about jobs in Florida, the frustrations, the difficulties that the State Department of Economic Opportunity has had in rolling out a new online unemployment benefit claims process and website. Meantime, the Public-Private Economic Development Agency for the state called Enterprise Florida met in Coral Gables this week. And while the group boasted about an increase in job creation forecasts for the years ahead, a watchdog group certainly criticized Enterprise Florida. This watchdog group called Good Jobs First accused the strategy of public-private economic development agencies as, quote, costly failures criticized by misuse of taxpayer funds, conflicts of interest, excessive executive pay, questionable subsidy awards, exaggerated job creation claims, lack of transparency, and resistance to oversight, end quote. Gina, why such harsh accusations?
Well, I think the big issue is that you can be on the board as long as you pay $50,000, and that is allowed, but the issue of cronyism keeps coming up, particularly from the group Integrity Florida. So in a way, it does look as though you can buy your way onto the board and then get state contracts in return.
Well, and let's break this apart a little bit, Steve. Buying your way onto the board. Enterprise Florida perhaps has a cost to sit on the board of directors of this public-private partnership. And the accusation on the part of Good Jobs First, a national group, and another group, Integrity Florida, more localized here in the Sunshine State, is that's a pay-for-play scenario. Pay to get on the board so that you can play with some of these lucrative state contracts and subsidies. Do we know of any actual connections between those two, though?
There have been some. I can't say them off the top of my head. My paper, the Tampa Bay Times, has documented them over the years. It's $50,000, by the way. But a little bit of historical perspective is in order here.
Please.
Who created Enterprise Florida? I'll tell you who, a Democrat, Lawton Childs. Enterprise Florida has been around since 1992 when Lawton Childs was the governor of the state, and the feeling was that the quote, Department of Commerce, which, by the way, was once headed by Jeb Bush, was a bureaucratic mess that was very slow-moving, so they created this public-private partnership. When you create a PPP, you invite these kinds of overlapping conflicts of interest and so forth. In my judgment as a reporter, there's way too little Enterprise Florida is shielded from a lot of the public records requirements. For example, Gray Swope, who runs Enterprise Florida, is not required to file financial disclosure. He's not subject to confirmation by the Florida Senate. The Enterprise Florida board members are, and they tend to be very successful leaders of business, lawyers, business owners around the state who are very much a part of the political fabric of the state, mostly Republican, but there's some Democrats on the EFI board as well.
You mentioned the CEO, Gary Swope. He did get a new contract, we learned this week, $275,000, a maximum bonus of $100,000. This comes just a few months after his most recent bonus of, I believe it was around $70,000. As scandal kind of plagues Enterprise Florida, Steve, you mentioned this is a public-private partnership that's been operating for the better part of a half generation. Do these scandals or do these questions about the integrity stick this time around?
I don't know that they do. The folks at Integrity Florida, Dan Krasner, he's made this now almost a crusade about Enterprise Florida. The governor of this state, Rick Scott, who is facing the voters in 1 year, Rick Scott never misses an opportunity to tell the public what a great job Gray Swope is doing. He was recruited from Mississippi to this state. Gray Swope will argue that other states are beating us by offering more generous incentive packages to employers than we are. Scott loves Gray Swope. Scott recruited Gray Swope. So, you know, if there's going to be a problem with Enterprise Florida down the road, it's going to reflect directly on this governor.
And it's such a dichotomy for such a free market governor like Governor Scott to talk about his support for somebody who has been very vocal in the use of state subsidies to attract enterprise to the state. Certainly that that is filled with political irony in a time when he is running for re-election.
Absolutely, it is. You know, this is the so-called jobs governor. Now he's branched out his agenda slightly to include K-12 education and to some degree colleges and universities. But his fortunes will sink or swim on and from his point of view as to how well he has affected the economy of the state of Florida.
Yeah, and that is an issue. We've got more details on our web chat right now at WLRN.org. Florida's economy at a glance from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, as well as a PolitiFact issue on the governor's consistent claim that he's halfway through his campaign goal of creating 700,000 jobs in 7 years, because job growth so far, as we heard at the beginning of the program, according to the governor, 360,000 jobs, consistent with normal job growth. You'll find that all at WLRN.org. Steve Bosquet from the Tampa Bay Times with us from Tampa Bay, from Tallahassee, the capital city, Gina Jordan with WLRN Miami Herald News. Thank you to you both for joining us here on the Florida Roundup. We've got a lot more to come, including one of the longest serving death row inmates learns his execution date. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Thomas Knight is 62 years old. Back in 1974, he kidnapped a paper bag company owner from Bay Harbor Island and his wife. At rifle point, he forced them to a downtown Miami bank to withdraw $50,000. Knight then killed Sidney and Lillian Gans. He was sentenced to death. Now, while on Florida's death row in 1980, Knight stabbed a corrections officer, Richard Burke, to death. On December 3rd of this year, Knight is scheduled to be executed for the Burke murder, making the killer, Knight, one of the longest-serving Florida death row inmates. Let's talk about the death penalty in the Sunshine State. Email us your questions and comments at the Florida Roundup at WLRNnews.org. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576, or join the online discussion on Twitter at WLRN and on the website WLRN.org. Steve Bosquet from the Tampa Bay Times continues with us here on the Florida Roundup, and Brendan Farrington is with the Associated Press in Tallahassee. Brendan, what are the lessons that we should learn from the Thomas Knight case, from 1974, a kidnap and murder, to a December 3rd, 2013 scheduled execution date?
Well, a lot of victims' families believe that the process is too slow from the time of sentencing to time of execution. And while lawmakers have addressed this, they addressed this under Jeb Bush, and clearly this year they did the same. There doesn't seem to be a way to get things speeded up.
Well, the legislature did pass the Timely Justice Act, which is designed to accelerate the execution process. How is that supposed to work as Florida moves into the future?
Well, it's supposed to streamline appeals, but it's not as if some people have argued that it's not really going to be effective in speeding up cases. I mean, there's still appeals that have to be exhausted. There's the parole board review, and it's still going to take some time before these cases actually get to the governor.
Steve, you know the legislative environment in Tallahassee. What was that environment like for this act to have passed, and what were the hopes versus what Brendan's talking about are the realities?
Sure. Like a lot of what happens in Tallahassee, and perhaps not enough, this effort was fueled in some degree by the news media, by news media coverage. Senator Joe Negron, who's from the Treasure Coast, Stewart, Martin County, had seen a whole series of stories in his hometown paper about people, cases languishing on death row for decades. And he decided to file this bill, which, though it accelerates the review process, it does not deny any inmate any appeal rights that they have now. It really has not had any effect, really. It's I would say the pace of executions has accelerated very slightly. We've had a couple more than usual. But this state does not execute more than maybe 3 or 4 people a year on average. There are about 400 people on death row. My colleague at the Times, Bill Stevens, writing recently about another death penalty case, made the observation that it took less time for Germany to rebuild itself after World War II than it takes Florida to execute some of these inmates. Now, we can have a debate over capital punishment, of course, and people feel strongly about it both ways. But Thomas Knight, the case that you're talking about here today, has been on death row since 1975.
Yeah, and you talked about more than 400 people in Florida are on death row here in the Sunshine State. That's a number people ought to keep in mind. And talking about the pace of executions here, Brendan, despite the legislative effort, we saw one or two executions per year, maybe none at all over the last several years. But recently, the Governor Scott has signed 11 death warrants since coming into office back in January of 2011, six of them in the past few months. So the pace that has been accelerated has been driven by the executive branch, not the legislative branch.
Yeah, exactly. Rick Scott has been signing warrants at a pace, much more so than Charlie Crist or Jeb Bush. I think if you go back, you might see Bob Graham had signed the most when he was in office.
Yeah, Brendan Farrington with the Associated Press with Tallahassee. You witnessed the most recent death row execution in the Sunshine State, correct?
Yes, I did. Correct.
Tell us about that experience.
Well, it's kind of a surreal experience. And you're in a room. There's four rows of chairs, 10 chairs each. The media sits in the back and on a row that's slightly elevated. You have witnesses that are family members, friends, spiritual advisors. And when you walk into the room, it's very quiet. There's a rectangular glass window with a screen across it. And when they're ready, they lift the screen. The inmate is strapped to a gurney with IV lines in his arms. And he's asked if he wants to make last words, if he has any last words. In this case, he did. It was William Happ. He admitted that he committed the crime, was the murder of Angie Crowley back in 1986, and he expressed remorse, hoped for forgiveness from God, but did not expect it from the family. And from there, the execution proceeds. The inmate is sedated. As you know, there's a new mix of drugs in Florida. In this case, it seemed to have taken longer for the condemned prisoner to actually lose consciousness. And from start to finish, it's about a 14-minute procedure.
Florida did change recently the mixture of medications used for the lethal injection. The execution, Brendan, that you witnessed was the first time that mixture was used. The death penalty alone has plenty of criticism and controversy around it. This new mixture does as well. A spokesperson for the State Department of Corrections said the agency did research on the new mixture before it was used earlier this fall.
It is our job to do that in the most dignified and humane way possible.
But clearly some critics have come out viewing the state's use of this drug mixture very, very differently.
This is really an experiment on a human being.
So, Brendan, what do we know about this new drug mixture? We know that several inmates on Florida's death row are challenging the use of it in court. But what do we know about the compounds being used?
Well, the William Happ execution was the first time that this is used, and the first drug used to render the condemned inmate unconscious is an anti-anxiety drug. It's along the lines of Valium or Ativan, and the argument that lawyers are making for death row inmates is that it doesn't adequately bring the
it's not an anesthetic.
Inmate.
It's not an anesthetic.
Right,
it's not
right.
A painkiller per se. It's anti-anxiety, but it's not to eliminate pain.
Right, exactly.
That's the claim.
And they fear that the inmate wants the other two drugs. The first is to paralyze the other two is to paralyze the inmate, and the third is to induce cardiac arrest. And they fear that if they're not properly anesthetized, then they'll feel extreme pain during the next steps in the procedure.
Yeah, the source really of the complaint on the part of the inmates for this drug mixture is that first drug is not intended medically as an anesthetic. Instead, it's for sedation.
Right. It's often used as a drug given to a patient before they're given an anesthetic, basically to relieve their anxiety before preparing for surgery. Yeah.
Why was the drug mixture changed?
The drug that that Florida had been using is no longer available. There's a foreign manufacturer that's just decided not to sell it to states for uses in executions.
Which, Steve, interestingly goes to the point of the ability of the marketplace to supply, I suppose, the medicines that states with the death penalty need in order to carry it out.
That's right. Now, you know, the lawyers for the death row inmates are objecting also to the fact that we use this three-drug mixture. It's a three-stage process. The majority of states that have capital punishment use one drug. We've opted to use three. It's a matter of fact that there have been problems with executions in the past, frankly, more with the electric chair than with lethal injection. We've been using lethal injection now for more than a decade. We're going to have legal arguments on this case in the federal court in Jacksonville on November 6th, where the lawyers are trying to stop the next execution from taking place, from going forward, because of objections to the use of this new drug.
Yeah. Brendan from the Associated Press, Brendan Farrington, talk to us about the schedule here. The federal court challenge of the use of the drug mixture in Florida happening just next week. In the meantime, Thomas Knight's execution set on December 3rd.
And we also have an execution scheduled for November 12th as well. So the hearing in Jacksonville could play a role in that. The November 12th execution, the lawyers have used a different argument that there was not a unanimous jury decision recommending the death penalty, but the Supreme Court has rejected that, as it has in previous cases.
And this gets back again to how the death penalty is administered or legally administered in the state of Florida. Florida, I believe, is the sole state in the union with the capital punishment that does not require at least a supermajority jury verdict. Is that correct?
I cannot tell you that.
It certainly does not need a unanimous jury verdict like it does in most states with capital punishment.
That's correct. In fact, Senator Gwen Margolis of Miami has again, it comes up every year, that bill is filed to require a unanimous jury verdict to recommend a death sentence. You know, the final decision technically does rest with the judge in every case. But that bill probably won't pass. It never passes.
That is Steve Bosquet from the Tampa Bay Times with us in Tampa today on the Florida Roundup. Brendan Farrington from the Associated Press with us from Tallahassee, talking about capital punishment, how it is administered here in the Sunshine State of Florida. And clearly, it is not easy. And in Florida, it's also been a campaign fundraising issue over the past several weeks. Attorney General Pam Bondi postponed the execution of Marsha Lee Gore so she could attend a campaign fundraiser.
I made a mistake. I'm sorry. It won't happen again. I asked that the killer date be changed, and he was given 20 more days, and it won't happen again. I'm sorry.
The killer Gore was executed on October 1st. Steve Bosquet with the Tampa Bay Times. This was surreal, to say the least, that you really saw this intersection of campaign financing and really a life and death matter, not only for the killer, the convicted killer, but also the family of the victim.
It was, and the final chapter on this sad situation, an embarrassing situation, deplorable, has not been written. Here's why. But for that serious misstep by Pam Bondi, I doubt she'd have a Democratic opponent. Now, she has two. The first one who got into the race is George Sheldon, a former state legislator from Tampa, worked in the Obama administration. If the Democrats can raise sufficient amounts of money, and that's always a question in a down-ballot cabinet race, and they run TV ads exploiting this very situation, Pam Bondi's in serious political trouble in this state, and she knows it.
And Steve, what's interesting is the debate isn't about the death penalty, capital punishment.
No,
it's about the administration of it.
It is. Frankly, most Democrats support the death penalty. Charlie Crist, who's about to announce as a Democratic candidate for governor, is a longstanding supporter of capital punishment. That's a non-starter politically with the majority of people in this state. Pam Bondi, the other problem Bondi has is the attorney general needs to be perceived by the public as being on the side of victims.
Right.
And this undercuts that to a great extent.
Brendan Farrington with the Associated Press, what do you make of this intersection between Sunshine State politics, campaign fundraising, and capital punishment?
Well, I mean, I think it surprised a lot of people, just the judgment call. You know, executions are a very serious matter, both for the victims and for the people that administer it. And there's no doubt it's going to be a campaign issue. George Sheldon, making his first public speech, called it the inconvenient execution and said that Pam Bondi should resign. You know, once it was revealed that she allowed someone who murdered two women to live an extra 3 weeks so she could raise money at her house.
Back to Thomas Knight, the 62-year-old who's been on Florida death row since 1975. The execution set for December 3rd, 2013. Brendan, is there any way you see that that could be delayed?
Well, I think that if they succeed, the lawyers representing other death row inmates on the new drug mix, that if the court decides that more research needs to be done, you could see a delay. I think a lot's going to depend on that hearing on November 6th in Jacksonville.
What are the chances of success for that lawsuit in the long term or maybe even the short term with a temporary injunction against using this mixture?
Well, I mean, the courts have stopped executions before to examine these type of things. And Florida stopped it during the transition from Jeb Bush to Charlie Crist. They said, all right, let's stop, take a look, and make sure we're doing this right. So if there is a question, if the courts believe that, you know, that there may be something wrong with this mix, then it could happen. Or they could just look at it and say, hey, we, you know, they did the research and we believe that the condemned inmate cannot feel the other drugs as they're administered. So, I mean, a lot will depend on what the judge makes of the case.
And those arguments next week, November 6th, day after Election Day, is that right?
Correct.
Brendan Farrington with the Associated Press joining us here on the Florida Roundup on WLRN. He's in Tallahassee today. Thank you for your time and your insights, Brendan. Steve Bosquet, always a pleasure to hear from you, Steve, with the Tampa Bay Times with us today from Tampa Bay. Still to come, lots more ahead here on the Florida Roundup. Are you ready for some professional football, soccer in Miami? David Beckham could be coming to Miami, maybe bringing with him a Major League Soccer team. Would you go see it? Where should they play? Where should the team play if, in fact, professional soccer comes to Dade County? That's a big open question. Tweet us your thoughts at WLRN. Join that online conversation at WLRN.org, hosted by Rachel Morello, or give us a call at 800-743-9576. If Miami gets a Major League Soccer team, where should they take the field? Where should its pitch be? I know all the lingo. I used to lace up. I used to have a kit. 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. This is the Florida Roundup. Thank you for listening. This is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Sometimes you get a little clip there of making news in the studio on the Florida Roundup. Thanks again for joining us. This is Tom Hudson speaking. We are on WLRN and the Florida Roundup. Talking politics now, Election Day, just a matter of a few days away here in South Florida. Elaine DeValle is with the Political Cordadito. She's along with us and Lydia Dinkova with the Miami Herald. And we will begin the conversation hearing in Homestead.
Good afternoon. Mr. Bateman, good afternoon. You're charged with one count of unlawfully receiving compensation or reward for official behavior, one count of unlawfully receiving compensation for...
Steve Bateman, now the former mayor of Homestead, hearing the list of charges filed against him. That was back in August, indicted on several charges there, and it really threw open the race for Homestead mayor. Elaine DeValle, political cordadito, what are the issues at stake as we move to Election Tuesday in Homestead?
Well, despite the arrest and the scandal that has come out of it, and the multiple scandals that have come out of it now also with the investigation into the CEO of Dade Medical College and other items, there doesn't seem to be a lot of interest in this race. The turnout is abysmal. particularly in Homestead, but really across the board in the county. And I don't see that the issues, which are in Homestead, traffic, overdevelopment, the turnpike and having an additional ramp there, business being more business friendly to the businesses, I don't see that those are really the issues that are being discussed. Instead, what we see is a very, I don't know if you agree, Lydia, a very negative campaign where, you know, there are just allegations and, and both candidates are pointing the finger at each other and saying that they're bad.
Lydia Dinkova covers Homestead for the Miami Herald, among other places. It's the mudslinging. The mudslinging has grabbed the headlines. Not only did it go negative, it has stayed negative in a big, big way.
I agree. I think that on some of the major issues, the candidates really seem to agree for the most part. But really, through campaign mailers and TV advertisement, it's really the mudslinging, yeah.
How did it, you know, this will sound like a naive question, but why so negative so fast? Is it the personalities involved? Is it because the Bateman indictment threw it open? Why so negative? And the accusations that have been thrown around go even back to a 1970s animal control question in regards to one of the candidates.
Well, a lot of people have actually been describing it to me as, you know, like Homestead turning into Miami in the sense of the elections. You know, it's becoming Miami-fied.
So it's growing up. Homestead is growing
maybe.
Up.
Maybe. And they said that they saw a little bit of this in the last election, but not so much. I think that, yes, definitely the indictment and the Bateman issues opened it up so that this could become part of the narrative. But I also think that because of who the characters are that are involved, because one of the candidates is the husband of a Miami-Dade commissioner,
right,
because there's a lot of county money, because this is going to be one of the most expensive races in the history of Homestead.
And talk about that, right? I mean, we're talking about a race that has raised over $100,000
combined. I would say that before it's over, they will have spent more than $250,000 on this race, where we're going to have, what, 2,000, 2,500 people voting?
Yeah.
Imagine how much each of those ballots is going to be worth then on the part of the return on investment for whomever may be the winner here. But Lydia, with the Miami Herald, why are these dollars so interested in this relatively small municipal election, the stakes?
Well, if you look at the campaign funding for the two mayoral candidates, who are Mark Bell, who, like Elaine said, is the husband of County Commissioner Linda Bell, and his opponent is Mr. Jeff Porter, a former councilman in Homestead, Mr. Bell has raised much more than Mr. Porter, almost more than $93,000, and Mr. Porter is lagging behind with $31,000, and a lot of developers have contributed to Mr. Bell's campaign, which is important because there are a lot of shuttered buildings in Homestead that are awaiting development.
But those are just the campaigns under the candidates' names. If you look at the PACs, and I've identified two PACs for Mr. Bell. Political Action Committees. And there's also an ECO. I call them all PACs, which is an electioneering committee. It's the same thing. They do the same thing, but their wording is a little different, and their reporting requirements are a little bit different. But Mr. Porter has one PAC that I can know of, one ECO, and Mr. Bell has two. And if you look at them combined, Mark Bell is outspending former Councilman Porter about 4-1.
Elaine DeValle with political cordadito Lydia Dinkova from the Miami Herald. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup. Join us for 800-743-WLRN. Let's hear from Homestead in South Dade County. Do you feel grown up now that this kind of mudslinging is happening ahead of your election day for the mayor's office? 800-743-9576. Maybe not something to aspire to in these times here. But Lydia, your paper, the Miami Herald, has confirmed that the former mayor, Bateman, has been arrested even today. We've gotten that confirmation as well here at WLR, and these are unrelated charges, but this is the former mayor in the room, the elephant in the room, the cloud over Homestead. How is this shaping the election? Would we see this kind of financial interest, negativity, interest kind of happening in Homestead if it were not for the accusations against Mayor Bateman?
Well, really, Homestead has been known as a gateway city for quite a while, as a city you just drive through to get to the Keys and to the two national parks surrounding it. But really, when former Mayor Bateman was arrested, it finally brought attention to Homestead. So
Certainly from the prosecutors and certainly from the media.
Definitely. But I think that we're just becoming aware, though, of what the political insiders have known for a long time. Because obviously what Bateman was charged with and the things that are coming out now, the allegations that are coming out now that are many, many years old, are showing us that, there's been this political business interest in Homestead for a while. It's just been kind of under wraps.
Yeah, and it blew up in a big way in August with the arrest of Mayor Bateman. And we heard the judge at the top of this segment read the list of the indicted charges that he faced. As we mentioned, he was arrested today, faces separate accusations in addition. What are the original indictment accusations against him?
The original accusation is that, it's a charge of unlawful compensation because he used, allegedly, his position as mayor to get a lobbying job that he didn't. Did not disclose in order to lobby this company with city officials in his own city and with county representatives who thought they were just talking to the mayor of Homestead,
right,
and not to the lobbyist for this company. The new charges, from what I understand, are seven misdemeanor charges that are related to election law, and I think they are related to the primary campaign. I don't have more details. We're still trying to get more details.
This was the news breaking as we literally came into the segment.
Right. We have very little details. The story is just breaking. I think that he turned himself in, and there are seven election violation laws, misdemeanors, but we don't know if it's from the primary, which was October 1st when Mr. Bateman tried to reclaim his seat, or if it's from when he ran for mayor in 2009. So really nothing has been confirmed yet.
You mentioned the primary race where he did try to reclaim the mayoral mantle, as it were, and there was even video of him on the side of a street with his election sign just a matter of, 5 weeks after he walked out on bail.
It was hours.
Hours
was
after,
hours.
Pardon me, hours after
hours.
Walking out
day.
On bail.
It was the next day.
Yeah.
He was in an orange jumpsuit one day, and the next day he was on the sidewalk with a sign.
Homestead, let us know what you think. 800-743-9576. 800-743-9576. That's WLRN on your touchtone phone. You can also email us at the Florida Roundup at WLRNnews.org. Tweet us at WLRN and the online discussion at WLRN.org, curated by Rachel Morello. This is the Florida Roundup, and I'm Tom Hudson speaking with Elaine DeValle, political cordedito, Lydia Dinkova from the Miami Herald, talking about politics in Homestead. We have certainly seen other relatively small municipalities have trouble with their mayors. Is there anything, though, Elaine, that is setting Homestead apart in regards to the volume and the velocity of these accusations we've seen leveled on the part of prosecutors?
I don't think it sets it apart because, look at Sweetwater, where we had the mayor arrested also just a couple of weeks before Mayor Bateman was arrested. Since then, we've had a number of scandals, one involving the towing company and its contract with the city, another involving the police department, from which the chief just recently stepped down. Now we hear that there's been money and other things missing from the evidence room. I think the same thing is happening in Miami Lakes, where the mayor was also arrested. And, from what I hear, my sources say that, the FBI has been back several times to City Hall to request more documents and that there are more things that they're looking into. I think what happens when charges like this are looked at, and particularly when the defendant does not cooperate, the authorities dig further, and we get more things.
And there's really kind of two ways to look at this in terms of back to Tuesday, which is going to be Election Day in Homestead and some of these other municipalities. One is voters stand up and want to take more responsibility. Stand up and say, we want to vet the candidates more and figure out who these men and women are who we're electing to these political offices. The second one, which perhaps is happening in Homestead, is
wash our hands of this. I have nothing to do.
Turn
I'm
away
sick
from
of it.
The dirty laundry. I'm not going to show up, not going to waste my time, and I'm not going to participate at all.
And I think that is what's happening.
And this comes on the heels of the 2012 presidential election, which, of course, here in South Florida saw a lot of difficulties when it came to the polling places. I suppose by so many voters washing their hands of it, not participating this time around, the relative lack of political races here, Lydia, that means that election officials have more time to fix some of the troubles that we saw a year ago.
Right, I agree. They do have more time, and there is historically there's a very low voter turnout in Homestead. Only 11% voted in the primaries. And when I was speaking with Bateman supporters who was running in the primary, they're really strong supporters of Mr. Bateman, and I don't see them picking any of the other two candidates. So I would think that the voter turnout in the general election is going to be even lower than the 11% in the primaries.
I agree. I think it's going to be much lower, and I think that this is not the election to use as a litmus test for whatever new provisions the Elections Department has initiated after last year's chaos, because it's just not, you can't compare it. I think eventually we're going to come to a conclusion that, you know, these lower turnout elections might need a shorter period of early voting, and the presidential election or even state elections maybe should need a longer period of early voting.
That's Elaine DeValle, political cordedito, Lydia Dinkova from the Miami Herald, talking politics in South Dade County and in South Florida here on the Florida Roundup. From politics to football, is Miami ready for Beckman? Soccer giant David Beckman reportedly wants to bring a Major League Soccer franchise to Miami. Michelle Kaufman has been covering this really for months now in the Miami Herald. And Michelle, welcome back to the Florida Roundup. This week, lots of speculation that a deal was done, that Beckman is ready to bring the franchise to Miami. He selected Miami. What can we confirm about this story?
Well, one thing we'll confirm first is that it's David Beckham, not Beckman.
Beckham, excuse me, Beckham.
But anyway,
yes.
That's okay. You're a man. We'll forgive you. There's no woman on the planet who would get that name wrong.
Well, his wife's name is Victoria. That much I do know.
Victoria, you do know. Okay, that's funny. Really, the only thing we can confirm, and that this we've known actually for a long time, is that David Beckham is definitely interested in Miami and only Miami for an MLS team. When he retired from the LA Galaxy last spring, part of his contract when he signed with the league 6 years ago was that upon his retirement, he could buy a team for a discounted rate of $25 million. The last few teams have sold for about $100 million, so he's getting a huge discount.
Yeah.
So he is able to buy a franchise for $25 million, and if he decides to exercise that option, he then has to choose a place and get investors together and figure out a stadium plan and then go present it to the league board of directors and say, here's my plan, here's where I want to have it, here's what the stadium will be, here are all the investors I have, here's my financial plan. So far what he has done is chosen Miami as a city. He is gathering up investors. There are a lot of people interested locally and globally, people from the Middle East all the way to Marcelo Claure, who's a local Bolivian-American billionaire who owns Brightstar Corporation, a cellular phone company. He is a former soccer player, 6'6" guy who owns the biggest club in Bolivia, and he's been trying for a long time to get an MLS team here. So he is the one who was seen with David Beckham back in June during the NBA playoffs. He took him to a Heat game and was sitting courtside with him and took him over to Sun Life Stadium, took him to FIU Stadium where Marcelo is on the board of trustees. So he's definitely a potential investor and has had subsequent meetings with him. And then Beckham is also talking to a lot of people that we don't even know about all over the world who want to partner with him and bring a team to Miami.
There's the question of finances here, which you're detailing. There's also the question of location. Real estate matters everywhere. It certainly does in South Florida. You know, the franchises in MLS that have had the greater amount of success have been those that play in stadiums that fit 20, 25,000. Is there such a facility that's ready to roll if Beckham is successful to bring a team here?
Right. That's the biggest stumbling block is the stadium. There's no question he will find investors. I mean, he has money and he knows a lot of people with money. Miami is a fabulous, you know, soccer passionate place, although it has not proven to be so passionate for the domestic end of the game, which we can talk about after. But as far as location, there is no current stadium that fits what MLS wants. MLS wants a soccer specific 25 to 30,000 seat venue that has skyboxes, that has really good press facilities, where the field is FIFA regulation. That facility does not exist at the moment in South Florida. So they are talking about building a privately funded soccer-specific stadium. He wants to do it in the urban core of Miami, which I find interesting because I don't know too many big spaces in the urban core of Miami. But I have heard that that they could use actually Marlins Park as a temporary facility until they build their stadium. It would be a little bit awkward the way the field is configured, but they have held a soccer match there before. They have a couple more planned this year. That is in the urban core. It is a beautiful building.
And it is public-private partnership that helped paid for that one. Michelle, we have to run. Michelle Kaufman with the Miami Herald. We are ticking down and our time is expiring here on the Florida Roundup. Thank you for listening. We'll be back on the air tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. Also on the website at WLRN.org. The program is produced by Elaine Shannon and Alicia Zuckerman. Our Public Insight Network analyst is Steph Farrow. Our executive producer is Peter J. Mertz. Paul Leary helping out with our technical supervision. You cannot miss South Florida Arts Beat next. Iko Iko live in the WLRN Performance Studio.